Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's day two of the WikiFed data dump. Who borrowed how much from the Federal Reserve during the crisis and how bad things really might have been? Also, the paper check tries to survive the digital age. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms committed to helping business owners and in-house counsel find local, pre-qualified legal counsel for over 20 years. Meritas.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today, the 2nd of December. Good, as always, to have you with us. The sheer volume of documents the Federal Reserve released yesterday about its emergency lending programs doesn't quite approach the WikiLeaks total of 250,000 or so secret cables. But for business journalists, boy, that Fed data dump is quite the goldmine. Trillions of taxpayer dollars borrowed, more than 21,000 transactions, and a who's who of big Wall Street banks that went to the Fed hat in hand. Citigroup, Bear Stearns, even mighty Goldman Sachs. And others, mutual funds, hedge funds, non-banks as well. Harley Davidson and General Electric, to name just two. All the cash did help dodge the bigger crisis, but knowing who got how much does raise anew the question many were asking at the time. How big is too big to fail? Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
If you're looking for a takeaway, a meaning in all these Fed documents, University of Houston finance professor Craig Perong has got one for you.
Just sort of confirms how scary things were.
The Fed's confidential documents reveal that Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Merrill Lynch got the most emergency cash. The biggest shocker was Goldman Sachs. At the time, the investment bank insisted it had plenty of cash, but records show it was sixth on the borrow list. Dick Beauvais is a bank analyst at Rockdale Securities.
Goldman Sachs may not have fessed up properly. It does look as if the Fed had not assisted Goldman Sachs, Goldman Sachs would have gone the route of Lehman and Bear Stearns.
That would be the route to collapse. Beauvais says more firms might have headed down that road if the Fed hadn't unleashed trillions in emergency loans.
It saved the financial system. I have no idea why people think that's bad.
But some continue to think the bailout is bad, that it greases the wheels for companies to become too big to fail. Boston University Law School professor Cornelius Hurley says the bailout encourages companies to take future risks.
Those that absolutely needed it, the Goldmans, the Citis, the Wellses, they are every bit as risky now as they were then.
And Hurley says the largest banks are even bigger than they were before the crisis. Thanks to the federal government's help, some are now more profitable than ever, too. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We told you the other day about Google maybe buying the email coupon service Groupon for as much as $6 billion. Now, Groupon is 2 years old, worth $6 billion. Think about that for a second and some of the other new e-companies out there that are being valued in the billion-dollar range. And then repeat after me. Dot-com bubble, anybody? Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Sucharita Mapuru thinks Google is nuts. She's a retail analyst at Forrester Research. In a blog post, she said paying $6 billion for Groupon is absurd, writing the company is younger than her toddler, and pretty much anyone could copy its business model. But
there are a whole lot of internet entrepreneurs now probably doing dances because this just, you know, created another, you know, kind of comp. I mean, so much evaluations are based on comparables. And now there is just this out-of-the-world comparable that just brings back memories of 1999. And we didn't think we'd ever see, you know, a bubble like this again. But we spoke too soon.
Still, she says, this bubble is different. In the late 90s, the bubble was driven by stock market speculation and greed. This bubble, she says, is inflated with fear.
The fear if, in a worst-case scenario, a competitor takes this business and then that results in our losing market share.
Firms like Google worry another Facebook could come along and eat their lunch. Saket Chaudhry, a mergers expert at the Wharton School of Business, says Google, Microsoft, and Apple are also sitting on hoards of cash.
Certain companies, they're in better financial positions. Now, that doesn't mean that they should squander their cash.
But
if you think a startup could hurt you, why not just buy it? It may turn out to be the next big thing. After all, even though Groupon's just a toddler, it's worth remembering, Google is only a preteen. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Even though it ran 2,000-something pages, a lot of the new rules that the financial reform law established have yet to be written. One in particular is vexing some big retailers. The Securities and Exchange Commission is drafting new rules aimed at conflict minerals from Africa, minerals that are sold by warlords and militias to raise money and buy weapons. Companies are now going to have to certify that their products are free of any of those minerals. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports from the Sustainability Desk that turns it into a supply chain story.
The four conflict minerals are tin, tungsten, gold, and a rare metal called tantalum. Lots of electronic goods, from DVDs to laptops, wouldn't function without them. So hundreds of American manufacturers will have to comply with this new law. But it's not clear yet whether the SEC will make big retailers like Walmart and Best Buy do the same. In October, a major retail trade group wrote the SEC arguing they should be exempt since they depend on other companies to make their private label brands. Harvard Business School's Rakesh Khurana says regardless of whether retailers should be held responsible,
I think responsible companies are recognizing that society and their constituents want to see them acting in ways that takes full responsibility for the types of activities that they generate.
But Mark Paston at the Council of Ethical Organizations says this sort of name and shame law is a bad way to stop war in the Congo.
It's kind of one of those things where we, meaning the U.S. government, didn't accomplish our policy goals. Let's push it back on U.S. corporations and on the U.S. consumer.
Even companies like Hewlett-Packard and Dell that actively supported the conflict minerals law say it's difficult to trace the origins of these minerals in the Congo, especially whether rebel groups have benefited from them. The Enough Project, a group that lobbied for the law, says rebel groups made almost $200 million in 2008 off conflict minerals. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street likes December just fine so far. Thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we near the end of week one of the United Nations Climate Summit down in Cancun, Mexico, hey, at least there's sun and surf, because getting 192 countries into a room together to solve a planet-sized problem with interlocking economic angles is way easier said than done. In the absence of some big, far-reaching international treaty, if ever there was a case to be made for the truth behind the old bumper sticker, think globally, act locally, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports climate change is it.
Carrie Knoki is about as close to no impact as you can come, at least for someone not writing a blog about it. She lives off the grid in a yurt in Sandpoint, Idaho, about 60 miles from the Canadian border. Right now, she's scraping flesh off a deer hide as part of a tanning class.
What we're going to be doing is churning deer skin, which I have a fresh deer skin I just got.
They're turning that deer skin into soft, supple buckskin. You wouldn't guess this class is part of an organized global effort to respond to climate change, but it is. It's part of the Sandpoint Transition Initiative. Sandpoint's one of dozens of transition towns around the world with the not-so-minor goal of preparing local communities and small towns for a very different future, a future dramatically altered by climate change and without cheap oil.
If we wait for government, it'll be too little, too late. If we try to do it by ourselves, it'll be too little. But if we do it together, we just might have a chance.
That's Karen Lanfear, one of the founders of the Sandpoint Transition Initiative. And even though the group's global agenda is clear, in Sandpoint, Karen doesn't talk much about climate change because Sandpoint's population's a real mix, everything from lefty hippies to far-right wingers.
And we can build community and learn from each other. And if that's all we do, then that's all we do, but at least it's a start. And so I'm not going to change the world, but maybe we can change our community.
And lots of communities, cities, states see it the same way. Michelle Betzel is a poli-sci professor at Colorado State University.
Well, local governments are living laboratories, so they can try out different strategies for reducing energy use, for changing transportation patterns.
London has congestion pricing for car parking, Fort Collins, Colorado is testing smart grid technology. Seattle is screwing in energy-efficient light bulbs. Chicago has green roofs. Tokyo's launched a citywide cap-and-trade program, and on and on. By some estimates, cities account for two-thirds of global energy use, and therefore about two-thirds of the problem. Betzel says it's hard to know exactly what the carbon impact of any of these projects has been so far. And she says these projects scale in a different way.
I would say the bigger impact of cities is really in this rethinking of how to deal with the issue of climate change and going beyond relying on national governments and thinking about what can be done at different levels of government.
Cities are also finding economic benefits to going green. So are small businesses. That's the sound of organic wine filling plastic bags that'll be tucked inside recyclable cardboard boxes.
It was a way to tap into a market that nobody had tapped into, especially with the organic wines. That's what we started with first.
Greg Powers runs Badger Mountain Vineyard in Washington State. It's pretty environmentally friendly because that's who they want to be, but also because it's good for the bottom line. In addition to capitalizing on the growing consumer demand for green, the wineries cut energy costs at their vineyard. They make their own biodiesel from local restaurants' cooking oil.
Our tasting room and offices are all solar-powered.
In many ways, the vineyard shows the role small businesses have to play in climate progress. One, they're using new energy technologies, reducing their need for fossil fuels. Badger Mountain Vineyard pays about $1 a gallon for its biodiesel. And two, they're tapping into the expanding market for environmentally friendly products. Bill Becker is from the nonprofit Presidential Climate Action Project.
These are the businesses, these are the sectors that need to lead the nation and then lead the world in capturing this market.
But finally, tackling climate change is about more than what small businesses or cities can do.
Climate change is a problem that's produced at the end of the day by millions and billions and actually billions of decisions each of us makes every day and how we use energy, ranging from whether we turn the thermostat down and the lights off to whether we take the bus rather than drive. And that's what the solution is going to be. It's going to be a change in those billions and billions of individual decisions.
It'll take changes in efficiency, technology, and the way we live in big ways, in structural ways, in some ways that require international and domestic policy. But in the meantime, local governments and businesses are moving ahead as testing grounds, trying to find a way forward that works. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
If you need some ideas for those billions of little decisions you can make to help save the planet, or if you want to share ideas you already have, our website is the place for you to be. Our green tip and trade feature is at marketplace.org. The euro got a little bounce back on foreign exchange markets today. The single currency was boosted by the European Central Bank promising more support for the shaky European financial system if, or perhaps when, needed. Although it doesn't use the euro, the United Kingdom is also supporting its fellow European countries in trouble, in the recent Irish bailout, for instance. But even as it helps abroad, the new government in the UK has enforced strict cuts domestically to education and to other social services. Sir Nigel Sheinwald is the British ambassador to the United States. He's here with us now. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
With this phrase, European debt crisis, being visited upon us yet again, what's the mood in the UK right now about financial stability and the global crisis in its entirety?
Well, this was the backdrop to our election back in May. It was the reason why our government said right from the start that we needed to attack our budget deficit really as the prime plank of our economic policy. So we've taken very serious steps to reduce our deficit from about 11% last year to 1% in 5 years' time. At the same time, you know, the situation in Ireland has got very serious. The UK has contributed to the rescue package for Ireland. Even though we're out of the euro, we recognize that our interest is served by supporting the Irish economy.
Do you thank your lucky stars, the British government, that you're not in the euro now? You can safely stand back and say, whew, missed that one a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a very clear commitment on the part of our coalition government. They've agreed that there's no prospect of the UK joining the euro during the lifetime of our current parliament, so for the next 4.5 years. But we don't look on with sort of indifference because we know that our economy, an exporting economy, is intimately connected to the rest of Europe. The UK exports more to Ireland than we do to Brazil, Russia, China, and India together.
I wanted to ask you about the differences in the way the British government and the American government have decided to handle the fallout from the financial crisis. The British government has chosen to much play in the press austerity. The American government has chosen stimulus spending. The Federal Reserve just put another $600 billion in the American economy. It's a distinct difference.
There are some differences, of course. But, I mean, just to go back a couple of years, at the depth of the crisis, our then government, of course, did choose to pump a lot of government help into the economy. Two and a half years on, we've moved out of that. The UK had a particular set of problems because of the severity of our budget deficit. It was the largest budget deficit in our peacetime history, and we had to deal with that. So our situations are different. We're not a reserve currency. Mm-hmm. We don't have the leeway that that gives the United States. We don't have the scale of the United States economy to fall back on. So a medium-sized economy like the UK had to look after itself, and we had to therefore take these severe measures.
Have we collectively fixed what went wrong to let the crisis happen, or are we still trying to catch up?
I think we're still in the process of fixing it. I mean, I think that there are a number of things which have happened, both in this country and in Europe and elsewhere in the world, which have had the effect of starting to fix the financial regulatory system. You obviously had the Dodd-Frank legislation in Washington. That's still being worked through. One of our big aims is to achieve a fair degree of regulatory convergence between the United States and Europe. But obviously, as the recent G20 meeting showed, there's still some way to go to establishing a genuine international framework for dealing with the imbalances which exist in the international economic system. And that is going to require, I would guess, you know, a number of further meetings and discussions. These things can't happen overnight. But from the UK perspective, finding the correct global solutions to these issues is very, very important and in our national interest as well.
Nigel Sheinwald is the British ambassador to the United States. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up, you remember when we wrote checks for everything and somehow the whole system still worked?
It's just an IOU that's like, hey, I owe you $300. You'll find out whether or not I have it later.
Yeah, I remember those days. But first, let's do the numbers. Worries about Europe? What worries? Dow Industrials picked up 106 points today, just shy of 1%, closed at 11,362. The NASDAQ ticked up 1.1%, 29 points, 25.79 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 1.25%, 15 points, ended the day at 12.21. Financial firms were a little less nervous today. Wells Fargo banked 4.5%. Bank of America deposited close to 3.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase picked up 3% on this Thursday. Strong sales numbers for November lifted some retail stocks. Target aimed nearly 3% higher. JCPenney bagged 2.25%. Tiffany turned up nearly 0.75%. Bonds fell ever so slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.99%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com.
By the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Senate Armed Services Committee continues discussing the policy on gays in the military. How long are the unemployment lines? The Labor Department reports on numbers for November. And on December 3rd, 1947, a streetcar named Desire opened on Broadway with Marlon Brando and Jessica Tandy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media, and I'm Kai Ruzdahl with an apology to the e-shoppers among you who might be listening. I took a swipe at online gift giving the other day, said there's not much effort or emotion involved in just clicking and gifting. But then the weekend's retail numbers came out. Foot traffic in stores was up, but actual sales figures didn't quite match. And at the same time, online purchases rose as much as 19% over a year ago. So could that all mean that shoppers did take the time and energy to go to stores and, I don't know, maybe finger the actual merchandise and then go home and search out a cheaper price online? Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has been testing the theory.
I didn't have to look far to find one of these cheapskates, just a few steps to the office of Betsy Streisand, one of our Marketplace editors. She wanted to buy some flat screens for her new home.
I didn't want to buy a TV without actually looking at the TV and seeing the picture. So I went to Best Buy,
where she apologized to the salesman for spending a half hour of his busy Black Friday learning about flat screens.
He even pulled the little cards they give you that describe the TV that you use to pay for it, and he made me a copy of them. And I left. I drove home, plugged in the numbers from the paper he gave me, and I bought three televisions from Amazon. I was really happy I saved money, but I feel bad about it.
The number of consumers over Black Friday weekend that said that they did this was about 6.3%.
Britt Beamer tracks consumer behavior at America's Research Group. He says in these tight times for retailers, even such a small but growing number of see-it-in-person, buy-it-online shoppers could mean the difference between make-or-break sales. So why didn't salesperson Jackie Martinez sound all that concerned when I got her on the phone at an L.A.-area Best Buy store?
We're actually flattered that, you know, people come to Best Buy to get our information. You can't get everybody, right?
Martinez says you get what you pay for. Real stores offer more services, support, and the quick return of a purchase if you're not happy. Still, there are signs that brick-and-mortar retailers are taking note of the growing competition. Industry consultant Britt Beamer points to the bargain TVs Walmart offered over Black Friday. Through a deal with the manufacturer, one particular model was available nowhere else.
So Walmart could have an exclusive product that could not be shopped easily unless you could find out everything about that TV set and compare it all the specs from TV to TV, and that's very difficult to do.
But the competition might not be as cagey as shoppers like our editor Betsy.
Probably the other things I buy at Best Buy, and I do buy other things at Best Buy, I'm probably paying for the time for that salesperson to educate me in televisions, which I do not buy at Best Buy.
What do you think? Which buy is best? I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Let us know. Letters at marketplace.org. You know, paper is just so out. It's been around in various forms for thousands of years. There's nothing sparkly or shiny about it. Now it's Kindles and texting and online bill paying that are the new things. So maybe it's time to say goodbye to letters and newspapers and paper checks. Maybe. But one company is fighting back. Sally Herships has more.
When I was young, you had to go to the bank to do your banking. Fax machines were still a big deal. Now I do a lot of my transactions online, but I still use some paper checks. I'm almost 40. Roseanne Malfucci is 29. She's a DJ and lives in Brooklyn.
I use checks only when I have to. I kind of hate using them, and I think they're antiquated.
Because?
It's just an IOU that's like, hey, I owe you $300. You'll find out whether or not I have it later.
And?
The other thing that I really hate is that your account number's on it.
Malfucci says that doesn't seem very secure. But even if she did want to write a check, a lot of businesses won't take them. Beth Fahey owns a specialty bakery outside Chicago. She designs cakes.
And sometimes some of our customers have champagne wishes and a Budweiser budget.
When the recession hit, Fahey's bakery got 6 bad checks in 1 month. All told, the bakery lost $600.
And if it's a $40 check, it's not worth it for you to spend half the day in small claims court. So you're really stuck and you just have to eat it. No pun intended.
Checks are in trouble. Take Deluxe, the billion-dollar check printing company. Susan Eich is VP of Financial Services Marketing for Deluxe.
What we've seen is that there's been about an 8% year-over-year decline in the processing and use of checks.
So Deluxe is fighting back. It set up a website called writetowritechecks.com and posted videos on YouTube. Meet Duncan Steele, the man with checks appeal.
Next.
Uno beef jerky.
That's Spanish for beef jerky.
You smell like pennies, 59 cents.
I hope you don't mind if I pay by check.
Duncan's Steel.
Duncan Steel is a fictional character that we created to really go after the millennial market.
You know, people in their 20s and early 30s. But how can you convince them, or anyone, to use a product that's becoming obsolete? Jonah Berger teaches marketing at Wharton. He researches how products become popular and unpopular.
It's really hard to stop consumers from moving that other direction. It's just hard when you got a better product that's out there for people to want to stick with the old one.
And it doesn't help Deluxe that the big banks aren't that fond of checks either. Check fraud costs the banking industry around $1 billion a year.
Banks love to talk to almost anybody about mobile payments and getting from where we are today, this Pony Express world, to the new mobile world.
David Eads is CEO of Mobile Strategy Partners. He helps banks get rid of checks by setting up mobile payment systems.
Of my clients, probably 12 of 13 bank clients pay me with paper checks.
What?
Yeah, and I was looking at it the other day and I thought, this is crazy.
Eads says banks are slow to change. Beth Fahey, the bakery owner near Chicago, says in a perfect world, she'd still be able to take checks. Credit card fees take a bite out of her bakery's profits. And hey, Marketplace, when you get around to paying me for this story, I'm fine with a check. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store. By Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it, ReputationDefender.com. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Two final notes on the way out today. First, the House passed an extension of the Bush-era tax cuts this afternoon for couples making less than $250,000. Everything else is going to expire. We'd spend more time than that on the story, but it is just going to change once it hits the Senate. Also, a tweet in absentia from our senior editor, Patty Hirsch, Oana Fellowship, about today's soccer news. Russia winning the rights to host the 2018 World Cup. All the Russians who are cheering, Patty says, must be expats, pointing to studies that show no big increases in income or employment when building new sports stadiums, as the Russians will surely have to do. And with that, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow picked up 106 points, just shy of 1%. The Nasdaq ticked up 1.1%, 29 points. The S&P 500 added 1.25%, 15 points. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast.
A toy is not trousers. A toy is not tomatoes.
But it is big business. A conversation from the corner office. Actually, the Toys R Us at Times Square with the company's CEO, Jerry Storch. That's where I was yesterday, by the way. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.